right, this is the final talk in this whole series, and I hope it's more than a series because I've tried to make a unified whole, a whole conception, so that it was all as one thing. And since the notes are from so many different eras, it was difficult to do that. And I want to thank you very much for attending. Because what happens is the talks are in part predetermined and in part spontaneous. And the predetermined part is all from the notes. But the spontaneous part depends on interactions with you. And without your presence and without your doing your own thinking or being what you are in your consciousness, the talks would suffer quite a bit. So I just want to say thank you for that. The talk for tonight is not a profound talk, but it gets at one of the central reasons for doing these talks. And what it's going to be is an extremely speedy presentation of too much information. But the information is meant to provoke action. And in a particular way or a peculiar way, we're going to end almost like we began. In the first two talks of the series, we talked a lot about long-term cycles, like processional cycles, and then we talked about even some very short cycles. And in this talk, we're going to again talk about cycles and timing, only we're going to be talking about now and what's going forward from now. So we're going to look at astrological cycles. And when we do that, it almost always begins with the sun and the moon, because they are the most dominant factors in all life on Earth. Plant kingdom, animals, humans, the sun, the moon is the most important two forces in our lives. Now, most astrology is longitudinal astrology, where you talk about things on the zodiac, and we're eventually going to get to that. But actually, there are quite a few different kinds of astrology, and they don't all use the longitude of the planets. For example, at one time in China, there were three different kinds of astrology, and more than three, actually. And they all had the sun and the moon at the heart of them, but not all of them used longitude. In fact, most of them did not. And among the Native Americans, there wasn't really an astrology of the way we think of an astrology, but they did everything according to the new and full moons. Yesterday morning, there was a full moon, and that could probably be called by them the full moon of the first flowers in the forest or something like that. That's what the timing is like. Now, one of these systems that is solely lunar is declinational rather than longitudinal, and I just want to use it to introduce the idea of the sun and the moon, so that carrying those ideas forward in longitudinal astrology will have a feel for what we're doing. In China, there were two principles. There was the principle of the yin and the principle of the yang. The principle of the yin was the principle of fire, of heat, of dryness, and of action. And so it was a solar force. The principle of the yin was moist and dark and cold and receptive rather than active, and so it was lunar in nature. Now, suspended between the extremes of the yin and the yang were five elements: fire, wood, earth as a neutral element, metal, and water. We have to be careful about talking about these things, because we talk about them in all of our images and our poetry and everything else is from Western culture. And in Chinese culture, they meant something different. So we can't look at it in the same way as the Chinese unless we get the feel for their culture. But the five elements were associated with the five naked eye planets: Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, and Saturn. So these would be the five elements. And it's not always clear which element is associated with which planet, so let's just leave that neutral. So in any case, the seven visible bodies were carefully watched every day: the sun, the moon, and the five visible stars. In fact, I have actually seen all seven within 5 minutes' time. I saw them at one time. There was a special time back in the 70s, that Jupiter was in the seventh house. I forget what was in the eighth house. I know Mars was in the ninth house. Venus was in the tenth. Well, it must have been the moon. But they were all strung out evenly across the heavens. And the minute that Jupiter went down, the sun came up. So I got to see them all at the same time. Yeah, I'd have to live hundreds of years longer, I think another 400 years or something like that, to be able to see it again. But at any rate, the sunrise was yin, because light was coming into the world. Sunrise was yang, and sunset was yin. Now, each of these five heavenly bodies had a specific character to it. Were flavored. This covers all of Chinese culture. They had a five-tone musical system, and all of their tones, the five tones, were associated with the five planets. All sorts of things of that nature. Now, if they watched on the horizon, we should make a big horizon here somewhere, I suppose. If you watched on the horizon and you saw where the sun set and where the moon set on the horizon, if you watched any of the other planets, say Mercury, suppose it rose here, and it rose closer to the sun than to the moon, that was a yang Mercury. And a yang Mercury was different than a yin Mercury. And so it was with each of the five planets. Each of the five planets was yang or yin. It gets exceedingly complex because the day itself was yin and the night was yin, and this is the strange part, north was yin and south was yang. In fact, everything was reversed there. It's a culture that may go way back to Atlantis. I actually saw one at one time. They had the famous south-pointing wagon. And what happened was there was a big fog. It's of a mythical character. It's a mythical history that an emperor got lost on the way home from a war in a fog. And when he got home, he commissioned his engineer to make a wagon such that it was an arrow that always pointed south. No matter how you turned it, no matter what you did to it, that the arrow would always point south. I thought it was back about 1972, I went to Chicago. It was the exhibit of 10,000 years of Chinese culture, and they had a self-pointing compass there. It was all completely mechanical. And it really blew me away. I had a lot of experiences in that exhibition that blew me away. But at any rate, this is more like telling stories than anything else. This kind of astrology was different from astrology, but it worked. It isn't always necessary what the form is, unless you think in a causal way, what you think in a causal way. What is important to begin is to someday I would like to offer a series of talks on the history of astrology, how all of the things that are in astrology now, what they can mean, how they can be used. Now, as we get to modern astrology is very cyclical. And if we want to understand the basic cycle, we go right back to the basic cycle of the sun and the moon. We just mentioned the Native Americans, people of all times and all places have had an astrology just based on the lunation cycle. And they've all come up with understandings from it. My own father, who never studied any astrology in his life, I knew when to collect bills according to the whether the moon was waxing or waning. So there's one quality to a waxing moon and another to a waning moon. If you want to put it in terms like we've just been talking about, the waxing moon is yang and the waning moon is yin. Now, if you're doing things, you do them according to the sun and the moon as much as possible. It's been known for hundreds of years that it's not a wise thing to do a surgery under a full moon if there's any possibility of having any problems with fluids. An exact conjunction of the sun and the moon is called the new moon, and it begins the waxing. Because shortly, 24 hours after the exact conjunction, you can sometimes see a little sliver of moon. But every day, the moon gets bigger and bigger until there's an exact opposition of the moon, which is called a full moon. And then it begins to wane. This is called a binary cycle. A binary cycle is a cycle of activity between two planets. Some binary cycles are direct and literal. Some of them are figurative or abstract. We won't go into that at all. So, in the binary cycle, you can say that the sun is giving light to the moon. And the moon is getting pregnant with the light that comes from the sun. But then, it's turnaround time and full moon, and then the moon gives back sun. And the sun gets its comeuppance for what its creative activity has been, and everything comes back to it. So what we're talking about is an attitude of giving and an attitude of receiving. Now you can look at the same phenomena in different ways. You could say that the moon is drawing out the sun and that the sun is releasing. Or you could say that in the second phase that the sun is drawing out the moon and the moon is releasing. Both work equally well. We know when we get into studies like Trinitarian studies, it's a well understood thing among modern Christian mystics that it is, how does it say, the Father and the Son share in potency. And you can say that the Divine Spirit is informing the imagination of the Light Spirit, or you can say that the Light Spirit is drawing out the will of the Divine Spirit. They're both equally true in the sense that both planets work in the state of pure spirit. Their activities work very well with each other, and so close that it's hard telling which one is doing which. So, what we're talking about is different attitudes for this same kind of cycle. Now, what happens is, this is the sun. The sun basically stays, for our purposes, we're going to say that the sun stays constant, and that the moon forward. It's opposite. the yang quality of the first half of the cycle is a building half. The second half is a deteriorating half. It's not only just deterioration, it is abstraction. It is abstracting the essence of the experience out as the sun and the moon lets go of the light and what it has formed from it. From this we can say that the whole first half of the cycle is basically solar in nature. It's yang in nature because the yang side is the side that wants to do all of the building. Whereas the other half is lunar because it's letting things go. Now, there's another way of looking at it, a secondary way of looking at it. When the moon is full, the moon has its most character. We talk about whaling virtues and lunatics and things like that at the full moon. And its light is the brightest. There's no moon to be seen at all at the time of the new moon, so that the further you go this way, the more solar things are. And the further you go to the opposite side of the cycle, the more lunar things are. So if you take this as a basic cycle and you quarter it, the first quarter is primarily sun, because the sun is giving out. But because it's closest to the sun, the secondary ruler of the first quarter is the sun. When you come to the second quarter, the sun is still ruling because it's the one that's blowing out the light, but it's closer to the moon, so the secondary quality is lunar. When you get to the third quarter, the moon is in charge. The moon is in charge because it's the one giving the light. And it's the moon's half of things, so the secondary is also lunar. Finally, the fourth quarter is lunar primarily and solar secondarily. Each of the four quarters of the moon has a different quality to it. Now what we want to do is we want to take this and abstract it. Because if we abstract these principles, we can apply them to any two planets that are in a binary cycle. And when we do that, we have a key for understanding the ups and downs of a cycle. Now, something like this is a process. Everything that we see in nature is a process. If you take grass, for example, there's a time when grass sprouts, and then it puts out, germinates before it sprouts, and then it sprouts, and it greens up, and then after a while of greening up, it produces a joint. Botanical scientists can tell you that the whole chemistry of the plant changes, of the grass changes radically when it starts jointing. For example, the wheatgrass producers will only eat wheatgrass before the wheatgrass has jointed. Then eventually comes flowering, and from flowering comes seeding, and along with the seeding, the whole chemistry of the plant changes. And the grass turns purple until finally everything has been put into the seeding process and the plant dies away and turns yellow and dries up, and that's the end of its cycle. Now, each one of these events in the process represents a major change in chemistry and in the germination state. The parts of the seed that are not used become fertilizer for the seed when they're released into the ground. The chemistry changes all the way along. And something similar takes place if you put in any cycle, if you put the aspects. Now, when you're looking at the sun and the moon, if you watch them very close every day and every night, It's a constant activity. You don't see a big square in the sky. You see a change. At quarters, the moon is half lit and half dark. What is the first or the last quarter? But the different stages where things change radically within a cycle are where the aspects are. So about here in the cycle is where this is a sextile. This is a square. About here is a trine. And this is the opposite. And then there is another trine, another square, another opposite, another sextile, and then you come back to the conjunction. These are the geometrical relationships between planets that have the strongest evidence of the strongest change in the consciousness of the activity between the two planets. And so aspects are internal to a cycle, and though we think of them as static, they're actually turning points. And they're turning points, each of which has a particular quality. All right. So now we have basics. It's a very simple basic. But if you think about it, just between, since there are 10 different planets, just between the 10 different planets, there are something like 45 binary cycles. And just in the nuances of the sun and the moon, all of the shades of changing, this takes place over 28 days, 29 actually. But if you watch each day, there's a quality to each day. The famous poet and theosophist William Butler Yeats wrote a book transcribed through his wife by mediumship called A Vision. And all the different days of his cycle, he says it's not astrological. Nobody believes him. Nobody listens to it. He says it's not astrological. I believe him on that. But it has astrological applications if you want to look at them. And the antinomies between the sun force and the moon force are very nicely characterized in the book of Vision. And he even wrote a number of poems using the ideas in it. If you would like to read, I have a copy of A Vision. The poetry is just lovely. You have to know a little bit about some of the figures of his time in England, because he states everything in terms not of abstractions, but of different writers or politicians or people like that being living representations of each of the 28 days of the whole cycle. It's a very lovely work, and it's something worth reading. It cost him dearly. Because what happened is when he wrote this book, he became anathema to academe. None of the academics wanted to have anything to do with him anymore because he studied astrology. Probably now they've taken him with open arms. How times have changed. All right, now we're ready to start looking at this in a different way. You don't have to study all of the geometry and astrology of all of this. These are things that you can feel by carefully watching yourself each day of the lunating cycle. You can feel these kinds of things. Now there are three different types of binary cycles. There are the outer, the intermediary, and there are the inner. All Venuses are innies, I guess. With the outer planets, the three outmost planets, these are long cycles. It's 250 years, I think, Pluto and Neptune. they're long cycles, and their impact is stronger. They're stronger because they hold the position long enough for the influence to sink in. their effect is much more indirect. It's usually understood through a generation, as a generation develops. The intermediate planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, are usually modifiers of the bigger cycles that come from the outer planets, and they put things into more concrete terms and they come closer to history. The inner planets, you have to really be on your toes to experience them at all, because they're very fleeting, and they give all the color of day-to-day existence, but so much so that you can be preoccupied with them and not see the bigger picture. All right, what we're going to try to do now is look at something about our times and trying to put this into perspective with history. And we're going to try to stick to very obvious things. We did some of this earlier in the Harari chart class, and we're going to do some more of it next year in the class on aspects, but it may take a couple years to get that far. Now, these are binary cycles, and they do have historical effect, but there are unary cycles. There's one that we looked at in the ephemeral astrology class this year. We looked at the unary cycle of Uranus. And Uranus, we looked at the fact that the world's, that the United States' biggest fires that caused the most death occurred in the same day on the same meridian of longitude at the same hour. Chicago Fire and the Pushtigo Forest Fire. And when you look at that day in the ephemeris, it doesn't look like something spectacular. It looked like William Lilly's prediction of the London Fire by something being exactly conjoined to fit stars and things like that. But what you do note is that Uranus entered its detriment, Leo, and the first time the moon passed over it, at the hour that it passed over it, it triggered off these great fires. And that's just what you would expect. Leo is a big fire, and Uranus is its detriment, so its most destructive nature would come out. And so this is the kind of thing that you expect. And then you say, well, that's just a fluke. If you look at the next cycle, it was the great Santa Barbara Refuge fire in Southern California, devastating in California history in terms of brush fires. And it was again the first day that the moon passed over Uranus after Uranus entered into Leo. So we can see that there is something to this, but it's so difficult. We as human beings are very insensitive. We stumble through life. We're more concerned about satisfying our personal passions than we are of understanding the spiritual environment around us. So a lot of this is lost. Let's first look at a cycle of extremism, which is a Pluto-Uranus cycle. These two we're going to look together. Pluto represents the extreme right. It represents fundamentalism, reactionary attitudes, fascism, laissez-faire, Hell's Angels, KKK, John Birch Society, and all of those things. Uranus, on the other hand, represents the radical left, the extreme left. Somebody leave? Not from here. Okay. Communism, revolution, labor unions, students for a democratic society, all of those kinds of things. The real extremes. But do you know those extremes can talk to each other? They can talk to each other very well, provided it isn't on political topics. They're both survivalists. Extreme right and extreme left up in the North Woods and you can find nests of people that are extreme right and extreme left. And they're all concerned. Oh, I get it. They are all concerned about government poisoning the food supply. So they all belong to the National Foods Associates. And they have these conventions every year and they get together and you never expect it. You find a yippie and a KKK member talking to each other and agreeing with each other. It's really quite something. All right, let's let this now be a timeline instead. The notes are not very good at this point, and probably getting Jerry Fitz at this point. At the conjunction of Uranus and Pluto, which is around 1850, things are switching to the slower moving planet, which is Pluto. But it's just like in a plant. When it dies, it leaves its seed for the next cycle. And the seed that was for the next cycle that was planted in 1850 was Das Kapital by Karl Marx. In 1868, approximately, was the sextile. And that was the Reconstruction era, and it was right in the heart of the Industrial Revolution. In the square, when things were the most extremely far to the right, was the production of the great trusts and the monopolization of things. In this whole period, probably from the sextile until the opposition, was called the Gilded Age or the Plutocratic Age. Finally, in 1894 was the trine, and everybody was celebrant. Then 1901 was the conjunction. Everything changed over, and it went toward Uranus. The thing, what always happens is something gets carried too far and that becomes its demise. When the greed of the right was carried too far, it brought on the depression. About in here, 1922 is the trine, the square is 1932. Right in the heart of the depression. But this period here, when the left takes over, right about right in here, right before the trine, was the Bolshevik Revolution, it was the time of the IWW, and when it gets to the square, which is, it gets to the sextile, it's the New Deal. It is 1943, Second World War. Things are, in United States history, you have to look at it differently in other parts of the world, things went very far to the left until the next conjunction. And then there was a radical turnover, just as there were revolutions here, there was a radical turnover again. And within several years' time, from the first back and forth conjunction between Uranus and Pluto, at this conjunction was the Watts Riot, and the Detroit riot and the Newark riots. And suddenly everything went from civil rights to black power. That both the whites went extremely right and the blacks went extremely to the right. Right now we are at this square part again. You know, we have the same kind of greed happening. We're in that stage of the cycle. And we can see that it is a time where things are just about, by the end of summer, things will have switched over and they aren't going to go any further to the right. There will still be some blow over from the extremes of the right, but if that's the way we're going. This is very fast, very careless, but just to get it through. So from conjunction to conjunction, it took about 112 years. And the first 180 of it was ruled by Pluto, and we are now in the Pluto half of the cycle again. Now let's turn to a different cycle. Let's turn to the cycle of invisibility. Let's look at Uranus and Neptune. It's interesting. Neptune represents the spiritual masculine. It represents occultism and magic and musical composition and all things like that. Uranus represents the spiritual feminine, mysticism and feeling, and devotional intuition. And they had a conjunction in about 1821. I don't want to mess the board up anymore because you wouldn't be able to understand anything I was saying by the time it got done. And in the first sextile after that, Neptune was giving to Uranus. And when it got to be the square between Neptune and Uranus, the phenomena took over. It was Neptunian, but it was the negative side of Neptunian. This was when there was all of the mediumship. The mediumship, the Fox sisters, there were huge cults of mediums in the United States, and thousands of people took up spiritualism. I think that has something to do, it's like wave action if you're on the beach. Before a new wave comes roaring up on the beach, things pull back. And always before there is a time of positive clairvoyance, there is a going back into involuntary negativity. And so what followed after that square, which was in about 1879, was the trine. And at that time, it was the glory days. It was the formation of the Theosophical Society, and all the way up until the opposition, which occurred in 1908. It happened in the same time that there was a changeover in the cycle of the Uranus-Pluto cycle. The trine at this stage, when things are coming back, on the Iranian side of things, in that trine was the Second World War. But in the Second World War, a whole generation of people that have Uranus trine Neptune were born. It was almost like the urgency of the war effort brought about the best out of humanity. In 1954, or about right in the heart of the Korean War, we marked the turnover point that Uranus was as far as it was going to go. And the sextile, it was 1967, so the flower children came in right under the sextile. And in 1993 was the conjunction, and now we're again in the first phase of that cycle. So what we're talking about is a cycle that it has to do with invisibility. I don't know how to say it any other way. There is one kind of insight that is intuitive insight that comes from Uranus. And you know that something is true and you just follow it. There is another kind of insight that and with that intuitive insight, you know that something is true, and you have some idea why it is true. When the two are positioned so that they're working together, that the mental intuition and the intuition of the heart work together, you have insight that's so clear that it's as though you're looking straight into the truth of reality. It is like if you follow string quartet music. You know, a string quartet is small and you can see everything that's going on in it. If you listen to the music, it's like looking through a window. But this string quartet, say Beethoven, is you're looking through a window and it has no glass. And it's that kind of quality that you have with the Uranus and Neptune working harmoniously with each other. Now, in the Uranus-Neptune, decline under which probably quite a few of you were born, which culminated in its first place in 1940, was between Virgo and Taurus. And it was on the cusp between Taurus Gemini and Virgo Libra. And the conjunction that just occurred in 1993 was on the cusp between Capricorn and Aquarius. So in effect, you had a cusp between Uranus being here, Neptune being here, and the culmination of it all in the conjunction between the three of them all coming together on the, oh no, that's the wrong cusp. Right here. All right. This is all way too fast. Sorry for that. Now, let's look. We have a rough idea now. We can see that from one of these cycles, if you're going to talk, would you please go outdoors? It's disruptive. We can see that we are in a time that we are extremely far to the right in the political extremism. In the other, you can see that we are in a place where we are at a new stage of a spiritual cycle, a new stage in the cycle of solarity or the cycle of invisibility. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you a picture of one of the major things that is going on in the heavens that is very much missed by almost all astrology. Before we can do that, we have to look at what is called the ladder of the stars. And the ladder of the stars is a fundamental sequence that is behind everything in creation. It's based. This is the Earth, and the transcendental planets are beyond concrete reality. They represent universal things. They represent eternal things. This is called the ladder of the stars or the ladder of apotheosis, so that by going up this ladder, you free yourself from Earth and come to the heavenly realms of consciousness. First thing you do is you overcome biological things, and then you gain control of your mind, and then you gain control of your emotions and such on, and all of that. The order of the planets is according to the speed of the planet as seen from the Earth. The moon is the planet fastest as seen from the Earth. The Mercury is the second fastest, then Venus, then the Sun, then Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. For the octave planets, it doesn't make any difference. I just put this up here because the correspondence works very well. Pluto relates to the unmoved mover, the primum mobile. The crystallium of pure light is associated with Uranus, and the firmament is associated with Neptune, the firmament being the embedding place of all of the stars. Now this, you could almost spend the rest of your life, I think I could give a talk on this once a month for the rest of my days, and have never exhausted the ladder of the stars, because it's in so many things and it's behind so many things, and all of the other cycles, including the cycles of the days of the week or the days of creation or the metals of Paracelsus or whatever, all of those things are within this cycle. By taking various orders out of this cycle, you can come to an understanding of all of those things. All right. The science of getting everything out of the cycle of the ladder of the stars is discussed by the Pythagoreans, and it's discussed in that book that you read just a few years ago with all the symphonies of the numbers, the Pythagorean number theory, with the Pythagorean arithmetic. All right. we're interested in here is freedom. We're interested in freedom and creativity. All of the transcendental planets represent divine states, and they represent divine powers. And we here on Earth, especially when we are on Earth, are the most limited. We are held in check by all of the laws of nature, and gradually, step by step, up the ladder, we gain more and more freedom. The most subjective is Cancer. The most objective is Saturn. So if you associate the different planets with different stages on the ladder, you get different results. I, for one, am one for, I'm a middle of the rotor on this. I think that if you're working with Neptune, you should work with Neptune and the Sun. Because if you work with Neptune and the Moon, you have a psychic. And the psychic has no freedom at all. They're subject to whatever overcomes them. Same is true if you put Neptune together with Saturn. You have somebody who's a predictor. And a predictor can never participate. But if you have a spiritual identity associated, you become a creative person. So this is what we're trying to get to. A free, creative being. Saturn is the gatekeeper. If new creative things are brought into evolution, they come through the gate of Saturn. If experience from this world is done and we no longer need it, it goes through the gateway of Saturn. The Saturn in this respect was called Lord of the Gateway to Chaos. And in the mandala, Uranus used to be called the Gateway to Chaos for that very reason. We want to talk about the two planets together that open the gate, whether something is coming in or whether something is coming out. And we're going to talk about Saturn and Jupiter cycles just a very tiny little bit. Saturn-Jupiter cycles are cycles of justice. Saturn is the planet that does everything to the letter of the law. Every little jot and tittle has to be taken care of for Saturn. Jupiter has to do with the spirit of the law, the broader interpretation, the principle that the law is supposed to simulate. And so between the two of them, they represent cycles of justice, one being very conservative, one being very liberal. Now, this is probably, next to the Sun and Moon cycle, this is probably the most studied of all the cycles. 4,000 years ago, the Persians were studying this cycle. And the cycle of judgment is something that goes back a long way. In the binary cycle between Saturn and Jupiter, Saturn rules the first half, and it doles out justice, and then the second half is ruled by Jupiter. Now, this is a 20-year cycle to be from conjunction to conjunction. This is the cycle that Arnold Toynbee wanted to have at the basis of all of history. He thought of everything in terms of 20-year cycles. Thomas Jefferson said that he thought that 20 years was the ideal time for the revolution to be reenacted. Now, each of these cycles has a figure which is associated with it, a geometric figure that gives you some insight into it. For example, the cycle of extremism that we began with, from conjunction to conjunction, it is 180 degrees, roughly speaking, from where the last conjunction was. If you take like the superior conjunctions of Mercury, if you mark them on the zodiac when they occur, just the superior ones, they form a six-pointed star. Whereas the superior conjunctions of Venus, if you mark them on the zodiac, you get a five-pointed star. So there are famous figures associated with each of the cycles. The figure associated with the Saturn-Jupiter cycle is the triangle. In fact, it is called trigons of Saturn and Jupiter. It works something like if the number one is here at 0 degrees of Aries, the next one will be 243 degrees ahead at 3 degrees of Sagittarius, and the next one will be at about 5.5 of Leo, and then it'll come back to Aries again, and so on. So that what it does is it produces produces the figure that is a complex of triangles. So the simple conjunction takes place every 20 years. And it stays, because it's a triangle, it's always within one element. And the one element that it has been in is Earth. And the first time that there was a conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter in Earth, that was a conjunction that it was not going to slip back to fire, but the first one that was complete and followed after was in the 8th house of the United States chart. And every president, as long as the conjunctions were in Earth signs, every president that was elected after the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter died in office, either by assassination or something like that. Ronald Reagan was elected after a conjunction, but it was the first conjunction in an air sign, and he was wounded, and that broke the cycle. He wasn't killed. The next conjunction after that was in Taurus, the last one in Earth, and so the next one that happens in air will be the pace setter for all of the cycle of the next, it takes about 240 years to go through an element. So that's the second level. And to go through all four elements is about 960 years. And to go through all four elements and to come back right to the first degree of Aries, right at the very beginning of the zodiac, is something that takes place about once every 28,000 years. Now, when we're dealing with these things, we're dealing with realities. Like, you know, the deaths of all the presidents were realities. And the trigons of Saturn and Jupiter are things that have been around for a long time. Another thing you can do, I've gone to the Historical Society and checked it out myself, that under Saturn, Jupiter, during the Saturn-Jupiter cycles that were in Earth signs, during the first half of the cycle ruled by Saturn, government land sales were always down. And when you came to the Jupiter half of the cycle, government land sales were always high. So that if you take a curve of the land sales and you take a curve of the Saturn-Jupiter cycle, they parallel each other. It's really neat the way these things work. It's hard to pick it all out because it's subtle and there's so many other things going on. But you can come to some understanding in that way. When you have something, you have definite knowledge. Not only did the Western Society, real Western Society, the Indians study Saturn and Jupiter cycles. The Aztecs, for example, had a calendar that was based on a Saturn-Jupiter conjunction that was sometime in a distant future. And that Saturn-Jupiter conjunction was one of extremely long duration. And so their whole calendar ended at that conjunction. And when that conjunction came, so did Cortez. That was literally the end of their society under the Saturn-Jupiter conjunction. And shown right in their right in their calendar, which was all astrological. Another example, there was an unusually long conjunction unusually long passage of Mars in Virgo. I believe it was almost 10 months long, and it went back and forth over Pluto. Pluto and Uranus, and the whole ramping up of the Korean War, of the Vietnamese War, was under that. You could see it really clearly when the new moon, for example, squared those planets in Virgo from Sagittarius, was the time that the Buddhists started immolating themselves. Just keeping an eye to the newspaper and planetary cycles, you can learn a great deal. All right. One more little tidbit to throw in there. That in 4 BC, there was a very close conjunction, Saturn, Jupiter, and Venus, and they were very close to the equinoctial point. So that was like a fourth level trigon. And that tied this all into the procession of the equinox, which we're not going to go into tonight. All right, after 25 talks, we're ready to talk about the reason for these talks. In May of the year 2000 was the last earthy sign conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter. It was in the fifth house of the United States. No, it was not. Well, that was the air that was it, that was there. The Saturn Jupiter in Taurus was at a different time. I'm trying to put two different things together in my mind at the same time, not succeeding. During this transition at that time, at 2000, everything was transitioning from Earth to air. In the cycle between Neptune and Uranus, in which all of you who have Uranus trine Neptune were born, that was on the cusp between Earth and air. So there is, like, in the psychic background, in this generation, there is the quality of from Earth to air. That's what's in the business. Now, in May of 2000, let's just make a line, I guess, out of it all. You had Pluto in Sagittarius and Neptune was in Aquarius and Uranus was in Aquarius. And you had Saturn was in Taurus. You had Jupiter, which was in Taurus. And you had Mars in the early degrees. Oh, it's thinking ahead again. Wow. Mars, which is in 30 degrees of Gemini. Now this is, you can see it, right?
No.
Talk about cosmic events, huh? Pluto was in first phase relative to Neptune. Neptune was in first phase relative to Uranus. This was first phase. In short, every one of the planets working from as far out as we go on the ladder of the stars to Mars, every one was in first phase. I've never been able to check this out. I've done some hand calculations. This is many thousands of years before you will ever see this happen again. This means the generation, we're only 10 years removed from this, the generation in which we live is a time that this is like the whole cosmos is foot to the floorboard. It's not like a conjunction, which is what most people look for when they look for energies. They look for the conjunction at the beginning of something. What we're looking at here is a synergy. We're looking at all of the planetary forces saying yes, saying go. All of the planetary forces in large scale are in yang mode. We won't see this again for many, many rebirths. And so the conjunction right around the time when Jupiter is passing Saturn and before Mars gets opposite of Pluto, there is a new moon. And that is a time that if you were going to found a religion or if you were going to do something to take advantage of this synergy and to have that kickoff time, that new moon would be the new moon to do it under. Now, this is sort of like fluid drive or torque mechanics in fluids. The synergy builds up, and it takes a long time for everything to be all working together. And though we're 10 years removed from this moment when everything was in synergistic, positive place, that's nothing compared to something that's over tens of thousands of years. It's going to take a long time for that wave to be damped down. So what we're talking about here is we're talking about that we are living in a time that it is excellent to bring in the deepest spiritual things and to affect humanity. We all know what happened at that time. It was a stock market crash. Hip, hip, hooray. That's a good sign right there that the material things are on the decline. There is this business that people are talking about with the galactic center in 2012, that the solstitial point will be conjoined to the galactic center, and everyone, including Rudolf Steiner, thinks that's a very significant thing also. So what I'm saying is I'm saying it in a very general way and not in a very specific way, is that we are at a place in our lives or in history that we can do something to help the world. This is why we do spiritual exercises, so we can participate. We can participate what's going on in what's going on, and we can see that as human beings that we are going to be the leaders of what's going on. We are now a creative force in the cosmos. Hamlet said, the readiness is the all. Now, before, even though we're talking about great powers, I don't think almost anybody got overwhelmed. I was very attuned to that period, and I was very careful in that period to try to feel it out, but I didn't, if you hear the music of the spheres, it isn't going to be like hearing a foghorn. You have to have a good deal of subtlety. It comes very, very subtly, but that's the reason it is very powerful. We especially have a lot resting on our shoulders. We are like the giants, the frost giants, Fafnir and Fasalt, that Fasalt, as soon as they got the gold, Fafnir killed Fasalt and turned himself into a dragon, and he slept on the gold. We have been given so much information, so much inspiration, and so much to share with the world that in spite of our efforts, we're sort of like Fafnir sleeping on the gold. And so it is important that we understand that since we have a central leader, as we saw since the thing in itself lecture on, and that we understand that we are guiding humanity, it is our duty to take over and start driving. This doesn't mean that we go out and become evangelists. If that's your nature, you can do it. But what is most important is we do spiritual exercises. And in doing those spiritual exercises, we become spiritual powers. And if we are spiritual powers, we have to be very careful what we do with our thoughts and our emotions. because we're broadcasting more strongly than most people. Our work is occult. It's hidden. It's unseen. And so the purpose of these talks is to focus on what's happening in the world over the next 500 years as we transition into the Aquarian Age, how we can see it in society now, how we can see it philosophically, how we can see it in ourselves. And I believe it doesn't have to be necessarily on the basis of these lectures, but these lectures should make each and every one of us aware of the fact that it is up to us to take a time and to be radiating into the background radiation of the world these principles. We don't have to go out there and wave flags and have tea parties or things like that. We can just, by holding our thoughts, can do something to influence the world to that end. And that's the purpose for these talks. That's about all I have to say. If you like the talks, if you think there's anything to them, please consider that this is the reason, this is the rationale for these things to exist. Please consider that it might be worthwhile, if you are a prayer, to pray in such a way that you focus these things. If you bring it up in the coffee pot at work, bring it up in the coffee. It doesn't have to be in these kind of wild occult terms. You can bring them up any way that you like. But they should be brought up and they should be brought into the world. And that's all I have. We can work and we can work together. No, I have not found, that's why I did these talks, is because there's nothing out there doing this very thing. Nothing at all. Sorry that I leave you in a lurch. The talks will be online as soon as I get online. I'm waiting for Apple right now, as soon as Apple comes out, because now I don't have the classes, all I have the garden and the counseling and preparing for summer school, but they will all be online, I hope, by September. It'll cost me a little bit of money, but because I'm going to try to get a dedicated, what do they call it, static IP line, and just run it all out of here. I might need some computer expertise.